Hi, I'm Luke Dennis, the Development Director at WYSO. We are happy we can deliver these programs to you, people who listen on the web, and we rely on you to help us pay for this service. So at our website, wyso.org, click Support This Station and help keep these services coming. And thank you.
Welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis. Over the 20 years that I've been hosting this program, I've always carried around a bucket list with me, people I'd like to have on the program, and unfortunately, some of them, like William F. Buckley, are no longer with us. I'll never get an interview with Bill Clinton, but I'm delighted to introduce my guest today. He's been on my list, and I can finally check him off. I'd like to welcome to the program today Ken Bodie. Hello, Ken.
Hello, Vic, and I'm glad that you managed to do this before I became part of the bucket list.
Well, you know, I had a pending interview with William F. Buckley, and at the last minute, they canceled. I was so close. And here you are. But you're not William F. Buckley. Can you do a William F. Buckley imitation? Did you ever meet him?
No, I never met William F. Buckley. The only imitation I ever do was Ronald Reagan, and I'm not going to do it here.
Okay. Ken joins us today. He's got an essay out in the current edition of the Antioch Review. It's called JFK, Earl Long, and Blaze Starr, Washington, D.C. Now, JFK, I think most of our listeners know who that refers to. Who are these other people, and is this fiction? Is this nonfiction? What's it all about?
Oh, it's entirely nonfiction. And Earl Long was the governor of Louisiana. One of the characters in there, JFK, of course. Blaze Starr was the principal pivot point for all of the rest of them. And the other one that is not mentioned in the title is Frank Rizzo, who was the mayor of Philadelphia, the toughest cop in Philadelphia. Then he rose to the mayor. He was Richard Nixon's favorite mayor. And Blaze Starr had something to do with all of them.
And that was...
Well, Blaze Starr, for people who are at least you're in my age, Vic, was one of the most famous striptease artists in America back in the day when there were famous striptease artists. And Blaze Starr had a penchant for politicians. And so, therefore, that's the way we get into the story.
And this particular sequence of events... Why was this so memorable for you?
Well, you know, in the same issue of the Antioch Review, I was asked to do a book review on a book called Blind Over Cuba, which had to do with the Cuban Missile Crisis. And it kicked off in my mind some of the things that happened around the Cuban Missile Crisis. There were probably 500 books written about the Cuban Missile Crisis. And there was one stray piece of history that didn't turn up in any of those books, I'm sure. And that piece of history is that on the day that John F. Kennedy, Robert McNamara, Dean Rusk, Robert Kennedy, all were struggling with what to do about the Russian missiles in Cuba, there was sitting in the lobby of the White House waiting to interview the president, a young woman wearing large transparent glasses and carrying a small leather briefcase. She was a magazine reporter, allegedly. The glasses were some part of a disguise. And the interview was certainly going to take place not in the Oval Office, but in the family quarters upstairs. And that woman's name was Blaze Starr. And she is, as I said, the linchpin for the essay.
We had lunch earlier, and you pulled out a book written by Blaze Starr, and I was shocked and astonished by this book. Apparently you knew her personally.
Well, I knew her personally, but not well. The movie that was done about Blaze Starr, called Blaze, and starring Paul Newman as Earl Long, and in that movie, Paul Newman talks like this the entire movie because that's the way Earl Long spoke. He swallowed some lie as a little boy. And Newman was a wonderful Earlong. And when I was working at NBC News, this movie was coming out, and I had become an aficionado of Louisiana politics. And so I knew a fellow down there who had a large collection of old newsreel, black and white photography. And I said to NBC, look, I'd like to go down there and tell the real story of Blaze Starr and Earl Long when this movie comes out. And they said, go ahead and do that. And so I did, and part of it was to interview Blaze Starr. And we sat in her backyard in Baltimore, Maryland, and she's still a lovely lady. And she told me a few things that had escaped the notice of most historians.
Ken Bodie joins us. Ken, you just mentioned doing a project for NBC. I guess we probably should let our listeners know a little bit about you and your background. What would you tell them?
Well, I started in journalism at the New Republic magazine as politics editor, then went on to NBC News and covered politics there, then went on to CNN and ultimately public television. That was my journalism career. And then I also divided it with academics and taught at Northwestern University most recently.
So you've met a lot of very interesting people. You've covered a lot of people that we would know. And I understand that you actually interviewed someone who was very much part of a political campaign as far as the advertising. And the advertising was created by a guy named Lee Atwater. I'm sure many of our listeners remember the name Willie Horton, and you actually interviewed Willie Horton?
Well, I did, Vic. It seemed to me, and it was not during the campaign, it was after the campaign, since nobody had asked Willie Horton what he thought about becoming the most evil, dangerous criminal in America through all this advertising, I called up the Maryland State Penitentiary and made an appointment to interview Willie Horton, and I did so. Yeah. He was not a terribly interesting guy, but he was serving his time, and the most important thing to him, because he thought he'd been misused by the Bush campaign in 1988 as a scare tactic, the most interesting thing to him, or most important thing to him, was that he wanted me to tell George Bush, the president, that he was not to be called Willie Horton. His name was William Horton.
And also, when we hear the name Earl Long in the title of your piece for the Antioch Review, we think of Earl Long, we think of the Long dynasty, of course, Huey Long, and we think of political corruption. You have a particular interest in that, don't you?
Yes, it kind of became a sidelight. In all of the journalism jobs I had, I watched for political corruption. It began with vote fraud. I got a letter when I was at the New Republic magazine from the Secretary of State of West Virginia who said, come on down, Bodie, and I will show you how we buy and sell votes right on the schoolyards where the voting takes place in West Virginia. And I did that. And I did watch them do that, watch them. And I did a lot of interviews with people who explained how it's done in West Virginia. It started out as little small half pints of liquor, and the price for a vote was $2 or two swallers.
And what year was that?
Well, that was long before Jay Rockefeller and Arch Moore ran against each other for governor, when the price for a vote went up to $50.
Okay.
And that was a gubernatorial race, because governor is the most important office in West Virginia. That is to say, maybe the most important, just after sheriff.
Well, of course, West Virginia was crucial in JFK's 1960 victory.
That's right.
Probably a few swallers involved there, eh?
Well, it was the primary. And the guy who ran that primary for JFK told a friend of mine, we just bought it down there. We just bought it.
Wow. And then with Blaze Starr, we have sex in politics.
Well, you do. And, you know, if you cover politics over the period of time that I did, you're kind of on the sex beat, because there are just so many politicians and so many political scandals that we've had over those years, ranging from Bill Clinton to, Frank Rizzo and JFK. Not to mention the Republicans. I mean, there are Republicans involved in this stuff as well.
I think my favorite, just sentimentally, will always be Wilbur Mills.
Wilbur Mills.
The Tidal Basin.
The Tidal Basin. The Argentine Firecracker was her, the stripper's name. And the they were picked up by the police. And the Wilbur Mills said he was not with his wife that night because she had broken her foot. And the next morning, Wilbur Mills' assistant knocked on the door of the Mills establishment, and Mrs. Mills came to the door and said, "Why, Adrian, the chairman is not here. I guess he went down to the district last night in Arkansas. He just didn't mention it to me." And Adrian said, "Well, Mrs. Mills, I have some good news and some bad news. Which would you like first?" And she said, "Well, give me the good news." And he said, "Well, you know, last night the chairman, Will Mills, went to the Junk Canoe strip joint, and he picked up the Argentine Firecracker. They were riding around in his limousine. They got into a fight. They rolled down into the Tidal Basin. The police came, and they arrested him, and it's all going to be on the Today Show in about 10 minutes. And Mrs. Mills said, "Why, Adrian, if that's the good news, what's the bad news?" And he said, "Mrs. Mills, I'm sorry to tell you, but now I'm going to have to break your foot."
Oh, my. What was her name? Fanny Fox?
Fanny Fox, okay. Yes. You're a good historian.
That name stuck with me. The Argentine Firecracker, not so easy to access that part of it. But, wow. We're joined by Ken Bodie, and we've been talking about some of his background and also his article in the current Antioch Review, JFK, Earl Long, and Blaze Star, Washington, D.C. Washington, D.C., inside the Beltway. You spent a lot of years there, Ken. What was that like?
Well, Washington, D.C. is an exciting place to be, especially if you have a franchise that I had to cover politics 365 days a year, both for the New Republic magazine, NBC, later on CNN. So it's an exciting place to be, but it's a changing place as well. I mean, I think it's a little harder to do the kind of journalism I like to do when I was there. And I don't want to sound like an old fogey, but we didn't have to compete with the 24-hour news cycle on cable news, Twitter, and so forth. It keeps things, I think, at a more superficial level.
When you and I get together, we frequently talk about various people that we've interviewed, and I'm wondering, who are some of the more intriguing people that have talked to you?
Well, I find the most intriguing people to be some of those people who kind of operated at the edge of legitimate politics and corrupt politics. And a lot of the people that I have interviewed and spent time with and learned a lot from have also spent some time in jail. And, for example, Edwin Edwards of Louisiana, the unbeatable governor of Louisiana, who often said, "I walk as close to the line of legality as I can, but I never step across it." And, of course, that was such a temptation for federal prosecutors that they ran investigations on him almost full time. And he ultimately did find himself in jail for 10 years. But being with Edwin Edwards for a dinner or an evening was like getting a graduate seminar in politics, particularly money in politics. And then there was a little county chairman named Seth Denbow in Indiana, Crawford County, Indiana, who sat, the first time I saw him, sat with me and explained to me on NBC News cameras how he sent out absentee ballots to people all over this congressional district of southern Indiana. And when the ballots came back, he steamed them open, checked to see if they were voted correctly. If they were, he would use what he said is the best natural mucilage in the world, egg whites, to seal them up again. And if they weren't, he'd just do something on the ballot to destroy them. and throw him away. Seth Denbo, a fascinating character. He told Richard Nixon personally, he said, destroy those tapes. They're your tapes. Destroy those tapes. Burn them up. Because if you don't do that, they're going to cause you trouble in the future. And, of course, Seth Denbo had that right.
Well, didn't Nixon preserve them because he wanted to use them for his memoirs?
I think so. I think that's probably the reason he did it. And I think that if he could start over again, he would canonize Seth Denbo's advice and take it.
Richard Milhouse Nixon is my favorite political figure in American history, and I have a lot of reasons for that. I'm wondering who some of your favorites have been.
Favorite people in American history?
Political people, politicians.
Well, you know, you mentioned one of them early on.
Huey?
Huey Long, yeah, Huey Long. You look at these folks in the context of the states in which they've lived, and Huey Long in Louisiana during the pre-Depression period, the Depression was visited upon Louisiana before the rest of the country, and Huey Long was a masterful politician, and of course, he virtually had assembled an army, and the opposing forces in Louisiana had assembled an army, and eventually, you know, Huey Long was assassinated. He was one of the more interesting figures. Of the people that I covered and knew well.
You didn't cover Huey Long? Just kidding.
No. Didn't even cover his brother. But
okay.
But
was that Earl?
That was Earl.
Okay.
That was Earl Long. That was the governor who was Blaze Starr's paramour in Louisiana, and who was part of this article. He was. They were. I think probably going to be married, but then Earl won a congressional primary and then had a heart attack and died. And so in the movie, at the end of the movie, it's a very touching moment when Blaze Starr comes in by herself at the end of a long night of people coming by the casket of Earl Long and lays a single rose on top of the coffin. And roses were her specialty. They were part of her striptease act, a very important part of her striptease act.
I see. That would be kind of like Sally Rand putting a balloon on there.
You're ahead of me on that one, Vic. I don't know.
Ken Bodie joins us. He has a piece in the current Antioch Review called JFK, Earl Long, and Blaze Starr, Washington, D.C. And what led you to write this? I know you were mulling over it. What led you to actually put it down on paper? Was there a defining moment where you said, I need to write this down?
No, it wasn't a need. It was kind of fun, to tell you the truth, about going back over all of the various events that one thing led to another. And I just decided to write it. And when I finished it, I had no idea whether it would ever find a place in any place in American journalism. So I asked Robert Fogarty, who had assigned me the Cuban Missile Crisis book to review. I handed it to him, and I said, look, you think I can? There's any place that might be interested in this? And a couple of days later, he said, I'm interested in it. I want to publish it. And I was really quite pleased with that, to be part of the Antioch Review. I have good friends over there, and also I have a lot of admiration for that little journal.
Well, the Antioch Review has been doing what it does for a long time, and it's highly regarded. And along with your piece in this current edition, we also have a number of very interesting other pieces, including essays like one by James Marcus called Arrive Without Traveling, India. Molly Haskell has written My Brother Writes a Story, Richmond, Virginia. There's another one by Patricia Foster, Contingencies, Iowa City, Iowa. Of course, yours is Dateline, Washington, D.C. Maureen McCoy is Fair City, Dublin, 1979. Thomas J. Cottle has written The Case of the Girl, Boston, Mass. Bruce Fleming has What You Can Learn in a Funeral, Albany, New York, which gives us the impression that we're on a map. And according to Bob Fogarty, the editor, that's exactly what his intent was. This particular edition is called Cartography 101 with a Twist. There's also poetry, reviews, all the good stuff you expect in the Antioch Review. And the thing that I really like about this edition is it's given me an excuse to interview Ken Bodie, who has joined us on the program today. Ken, did you ever dream in all your fantasies that you would ever be asked to be on this program?
No, I did not. No. As an author who struggles with books, I have trouble writing long-form books. I figured that your program and probably the Antioch Review were beyond my reach, beyond my grasp, I guess.
Uh-huh. So on the subject of political corruption, what else would you like to say about it? Are we still dealing with political corruption, or is everything okay now?
Well, let me just speak about one part of it that I was very interested in, and that is I considered the idea of voting to be the kind of thing that should be pretty sacrosanct. And so I spent a lot of time doing on the vote, what I call the vote fraud beat. In Illinois, in Chicago, I watched as the judges, both Republican and Democrats, showed me how they took a IBM card voting machine and just ran one ballot through 100 times.
In Illinois? I can't believe it. In Chicago?
Oh, West Virginia, there was a case where they they had the standby voting machine where people voted, and the real voting machine was in the other room. The sheriff ran the voting operation, and everybody voted on the standby machine. None of their votes were counted. The son and the sheriff in the other room cast all the votes in that county or in that polling place. Philadelphia, there was a guy with a grocery store who had registered over 80 people at his address. And he did a little time for that civic outrage. He did some time as a guest of the federal government for that. Louisiana, the guy who ran the voting machine warehouses told me when they got the new voting machines in, he said, just give me a little time and I can fix these machines to run a tune just like a piano. And so there was a lot of that stuff going on. I mean, and there was some times when people did pretend to be somebody else. And that's where we are with vote fraud right now. All these states are passing these voter ID laws when there really isn't a case to be made that is a cause of any particular fraud. In some cases, they just have no instances of voter ID fraud, but they pass laws, you know, against it. And those laws are always aimed at poor and minority voters.
Do you have any confidence in new technology like the electronic voting machines being better?
I'm not an expert at that. A long time ago, I spent a lot of time looking at voting machines, but I haven't done it recently, and I don't have the machines I've been voting on in small towns in Ohio and Indiana seem to work just fine.
Ken Bodie joins us, and he has contributed an essay to the current edition of the Antioch Review, which comes out quarterly and is available in all your better book emporiums. And his piece is called JFK, Earl Long, and Blaze Starr, Washington, D.C. Was that your headline?
Well, the only thing that I would have put in there was the Cuban Missile Crisis, because the whole thing hinged upon the Cuban Missile Crisis. But Robert Fogarty and I didn't get together to talk about that until it was too late to do that. And the day of the Cuban Missile Crisis is the linchpin for the story. And I don't want that lost, as a matter of fact. It was, and I think the readers will find that it was an interesting part of this whole sequence of events.
So this demure young lady who was waiting to interview the president waited and waited and waited because the missile crisis was going on and the president could not be disturbed.
That's exactly right, Vic. You got it. Well, let's not talk anymore about what happened at the end of this, because you got to give away the end here.
I'm not going to do any spoilers on here. I don't think was I giving away too much there?
No, I think not.
Okay. I think it's a great piece of history and one that I was not aware of until you told me about it.
You know, one of the things you should mention is that in the various places you can pick up the Antioch Review in Yellow Springs is Tom's Market. It's got a little bookshelf down there, and all the shoppers can go into the Antioch Review and read the, take a good look at the at least the ending of the piece.
I like a grocery store that has literary reviews. I think that's pretty cool. I mean, if you go around to small towns in Ohio, you're probably not going to find too many of them that sell literary reviews in the magazine section. I think that just makes it special. We have this wonderful little community that would do that.
I think you're right.
I'm looking at the clock. I see we're running out of time here. We're at that point where Alex Trebek goes into the final round, and we need to get as much on the board as we can. Go for it. What would you want to talk about here in this last couple of minutes? Is there anything you want to cover?
Well, one of the things that we talked about is I said, why don't you ask me what the most likely job in politics is to create corruption? And the answer to that is sheriff. In all over the country, I have covered sheriffs, and they're some of the most interesting people in the world. They have so much latitude in their jobs, and they run big political machines. In North Carolina, in the mountain counties of North Carolina, one sheriff after the other kept going to jail for vote fraud. There's a sheriff in Nashville, Tennessee. Never lost a precinct, and he attracted so much attention, finally, he also spent some time in jail. Hmm. His name was Lafayette Thomas, one of the most interesting people I ever met in politics, and I'm proud to say that when he died, I was on the list of his honorary pallbearers.
Well, congratulations.
That's right.
Was he sheriff during the early 70s?
No, he was sheriff a little later than that. He was sheriff in the 80s and 90s, early 90s.
Because one time I was hitchhiking to Knoxville, Tennessee to see the Rolling Stones, and I was warned, don't hitchhike in Nashville because the sheriff there doesn't like hitchhikers. So I was just wondering if he was the guy, but it was probably somebody just like him.
You know, Lafayette Thomas seemed to like virtually everybody.
As long as they voted for him.
That's right, and they did.
Okay.
They did.
Well, it's really been a treat having you on the program, and I'm hoping, Ken, that you write a book someday and we can have you back on the program, or you write something else and we can have you back, because there's so much to talk about.
Well, I hope so, Vic. Thanks for having me.
The piece is JFK, Earl Long, and Blaze Starr, Washington, D.C. Ken Bodie wrote it and contributed it to this current edition of the Antioch Review, and a lot of other good stuff in here. We also have a contribution from Molly Haskell, who is the author of a lot of different works, five books, including From Reverence to Rape, The Treatment of Women in the Movies, the memoir Love and Other Infectious Diseases, Frankly, My Dear, Gone with the Wind Revisited, and she's got an essay in here called My Brother Writes a Story, and this is an excerpt from a current book that is causing quite a bit of buzz about a man who changed his gender. You've been listening to The Book Nook on WYSO. For The Book Nook, I'm Vic McCunis. Have you ever wondered what was going on during the summer of 1927 in America? Probably not. We'll find out next week. We'll be talking to Bill Bryce, and he'll return to the program to talk about his new book, One Summer, America, 1927, in the Book Nook. The Book Nook is recorded at Soundspace in Yellow Springs and engineered by Chris Hertzler.